The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, folks, welcome in Sunday night. You're with Sweeney and the Waz on Sports Talk 1240. And it's Super Bowl week, 2 weeks before the big game next Sunday, February 7th. Tonight, January 31st, 2016, we bring you our pre-Super Bowl two-hour show. And our special guest tonight, since we are both big Jet fans, will be one of my all-time favorite Jets.
Mine as well.
22, Eric McMillan, who played for the Jets from 1988 to 1992. One of the extreme playmakers to arrive on the NFL scene. He'll be with us tonight. The phone number you know as usual, 631-888-8811. If you call in later on, we're going to give you a nice bio profile on Eric McMillan. And when he came to the Jets towards the end of Joe Walton's career as a Jet coach, well, the Jets were in a transition. They were getting away from the sack exchange. There was pretty much only one or two members left, and actually Gastineau retired during Eric's
mid-season. Right.
And the reason I chose John Sweeney crossed the way from me tonight. John, the reason I chose the song by LL Cool J, "Mama Said Knock You Out," is because I wanted to pick a song that was popular during Eric's time here with the Jets, and it also was from 1990, which was when the Jets switched their uniforms and put black.
That's right. Made it look a little
in the color scheme.
Right, I liked it.
And it was the first Jet jersey I ever bought. And it was he had the big monster 2 years under his belt, and I bought a number 22 McMillan jersey. It was the first jersey I'd got.
And it's looking good on you, I'll tell you that right now.
Right?
Yeah.
It still fits good.
It looks good, yeah, it does. It looks good.
You know, and my
sharp looking.
And my cousin told you before when he dropped it off, because he stole it from me, that when he had it, he was on the field at a Jet game. He got to carry a flag for the Jets, and he said when he was wearing the McMillan jersey, he said everybody was telling him and complimenting him on the throwback McMillan jersey. That was a great jersey. So without further ado, Sweeney and the Waz would like to welcome in number 22, former Jet safety, Eric McMillan. Eric, how are you tonight?
How's it going,
Eric? I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing good.
We're excited. We're stacked to have you on, and we want to give people an idea of where you've come from and where you've gone to in your life, including, most important to us, your Jet career, because we are big-time Jet fans here at Sports Talk 1240, me and John. So, but first, we'd like to give people just a little background on you, Eric. And I know your father played in the NFL for a long time with the St. Louis Cardinals. And so you were born in St. Louis. Why don't you tell us a little bit about growing up in St. Louis?
Well, growing up in St. Louis was It was really cool because I had a lot of friends that. Well, let me backtrack. Let me just say thanks for having me on. First of all, how about that? Okay, it's really a pleasure to be here. But growing up in St. Louis was a great experience. I had a lot of friends that really were very envious of the fact that I had a father that was an all-star football player, and he's on television, he's playing football, he's doing commercials kind of thing, and it's kind of cool, but, I can tell you firsthand, when you grow up and you got a famous parent, you always kind of grow up as the son of or the daughter of, whomever your parent is, and, it really gives you a feeling of kind of wanting to have your own identity. But, I had a lot of family there, my father's brothers, played pro basketball, and I had a cousin that was a first round draft pick to the Cowboys in 1981. Howard Richards went to the Cowboys, and then my father's brother, Uncle Shelly played. He was the first black to go to Bradley University on scholarship.
Well, that's fantastic.
He went to the Milwaukee, played for the Milwaukee Bucks, Detroit Pistons, and he later became a Globetrotter.
Wow.
And Uncle Floyd. That was Uncle Floyd, 6'9", and he played basketball, pro basketball, over in Europe. Uncle Shelly was 6'11". So I came from a family of Giants, and I grew up in a locker room. Literally, I grew up in a locker room.
So now, when you were growing up, you were obviously a St. Louis Cardinals football fan, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Cardinals played at Busch Stadium, so, you know, many days, you know, especially on Saturdays, I go to practice with my dad day before the game. You know, if they had a home game, you know, I'd go to the practice. And some days during the week, if I was out of school, I'd go to the meetings. My dad would sneak me into the meetings. And Jim Hanifin was the O-line coach. And, you know, I'd be in the meeting sitting, you know, literally standing up but kind of hidden between these big linemen. So I got my dad, you know, sitting on one side. I got Dan Dardall sitting on the other side. You know, and I'm in a room with, you know, Jackie Smith and Roger Worley, Larry Wilson, Terry Metcalf, Jim Hart, you know, Larry Stallings, Jim Bakken.
Right.
I mean, Jim Otis. I mean, I can go on and on about, you know, some of the Cardinal greats, you know, that I was exposed to. So my life was, you know, a little bit. I've seen the professional scale and the bright lights a lot differently than someone who played the game and never has seen that before.
Right. Did your father play for Don Coryell? Because I know he was the coach with the Cardinals for a little while in the mid-70s.
Yeah, he did. The Cardiac Kids was the nickname they earned.
Right.
They gave everybody a heart attack at the end of the game by coming back.
Right.
I want to ask you a question, though. Growing up as a your father was a, you know, pro, and you were coming through the – and obviously you learned a lot going up, but did you feel like you had a lot of pressure? I don't want to jump around, but do you feel like you had a lot of pressure when you got drafted or when you were in college that you had to bring up a high expectation to what your dad did?
I would say kind of yes and no. I always wanted to carry on the family name no matter what I did, but I wanted to make sure that I fulfilled my dream, which was to be a great player. And two, I want to, you know, represent the McMillan name in a positive light. So my father was a four-time Pro Bowler.
That's fantastic.
I had four Pro Bowls I had to make.
Yeah,
he set the standard, you know, and that's a pretty high standard, you know, to make. And needless to say, I didn't make four Pro Bowls. Didn't make his standard, but I tried.
Well, you did great. You did great, especially for us. You did great.
Yeah. Now, aside from your father, we'll put your father because your father's got to be your idol, but who was your favorite football player in the NFL growing up, aside from your dad?
I've always said this since day one, and I never, my story will never change. My dad was my favorite player in the NFL. You know, he was the guy.
Right.
And, you know, just like, you know, your fathers were the guy to you.
Yep.
He was the guy to me. And, you know, I have to go reflect back to the day that where it kind of really sunk in with me that, you know, hey, this cat is something special. This cat is a celebrity. Where he and I, you know, I used to jump in the bed with him and wake him up in the morning and, you know, pull his eyelids up to see, say, Dad, are you awake? You know, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And then the TV's on, and I look at the TV, and he's doing a commercial on television.
That's
so
great.
I'm looking at him on TV, and I'm looking at him in person.
That is great.
Man, I'm puzzled. I'm like, wait a minute. How can you be there and be here at the same time?
Right.
And then he kind of explained it to me, and I was like, wow, you're a special dude. You can be inside that box, and you can be right here with me. I've never seen that before, you know?
Right.
So.
No, you had it good. Now, growing up as a young athlete, aside from football, were there any other sports that you played, you know, in as a youth and up through high school?
Yeah, I played baseball. We started off, I played for a team called the Mets in University City, Missouri, and which is a suburb of St. Louis. And we started off in last place. And over the years, I played all the way from 8 years old up till I was 12. We ended up taking some first place trophies, you know, along the ranks in there. Baseball, didn't really pick up basketball until I got to, I moved to Maryland when I was 12 years old and didn't play basketball until I got to the East Coast.
Okay.
So, you know, basketball is really huge on the East Coast, especially during my era.
Right.
And, you know, I did that. But I tried to play hockey.
All right.
Really?
I was a big hockey player.
Hockey?
So I used to ice skate. Well, I can still ice skate, but used to ice skate all the time. And, my ambition was to be the first black hockey player.
There you go.
Somebody beat me to it, but it didn't work. So, and then when I finally got a stick in my hand and got on a team, when I got signed up to play on a team, man, those guys were hip checking me all over the place. I spent more time on the ice than I did skating around the rink. So I said, you know what? I gotta give this up. I don't like this sport, Dad. And he was like, All right, cool. You don't have to do that anymore. We'll find something else to do.
Yeah. So when you were growing up as a youngster in St. Louis, were you in baseball? Were you a Cardinals fan, or was there another baseball team you rooted for?
Yeah, I was. I meant to get to that part. When I was running around in Busch Stadium on Saturdays, a lot of the times the Cardinals would have baseball games. So I'm walking around the stadium. My dad's down in the weight room, and I'm kind of being babysat by the equipment manager, but I'm kind of roaming the stadium at the same time. You got Bob Gibson and Lou Brock.
Wow.
Ted Sizemore, Ted Simmons, and, some of these other Cardinals, coming in and out the locker room, chewing gum and chewing dip. And, I know him by first name, and, Lou Brock Jr. and I kind of grew up together at Busch Stadium. And, I'm just hobnobbing with all these great Hall of Famers,
Yeah, Lou Brock was a big-time base. I was a big Ricky Henderson guy growing up. And Tim Raines, I liked Tim Raines a lot also. So, yeah.
Brock was one of the best. Hey, look, Gibson, you kidding me?
Oh, don't let me forget, Joe Torre was there, too.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
That's right. Won an MVP with
Joe
the Cardinals.
Yeah.
All right, so now, your father, when he retired from football, was that part of the reason you guys just moved to Maryland, or did you move there because of your athletics and academics? What was the story with moving to Maryland?
Well, my mom and dad actually separated when I was five, but okay. My dad never left me. He always came to pick me up on Friday afternoon. So, that involved, him going to practice and then coming to my football practices during the week after his practice was over.
Right.
And Friday nights, I spent the night with him, and he'd come to my games on Saturdays. And, that's if they had a home game. And, also if it was in the off season, then he had more time. But, we moved to Maryland because my mom got a job. She got a different job, and it was in Maryland with United Airlines. She actually worked in McLean, Virginia. So Maryland is where she chose to, set up residence, and she commuted between Maryland and Virginia, on a daily basis, which was about 45 minutes around the Beltway.
Right.
And, that's why we moved to Maryland. And I'm so glad I was able to move to Maryland because a different lifestyle on the East Coast than it is in the Midwest. And,
yep.
I'm very fortunate to have, met so many different cultures of people, on the East Coast. By me being on the East Coast and came across some super, super athletes, too, growing up.
Now, in high school, were you recruited out of high school as a defensive back, or was there another position involved when Missouri recruited you?
No, I was recruited as a defensive end.
Oh, okay.
I played kicker. And I was the kicker in high school. I was the free safety in high school. But by the time I was a senior, I was a defensive end, kicker, and wide receiver. And, Missouri was the only school that recruited me for defense. Everybody else wanted me for wide receiver.
Okay.
And, knowing what, understanding a little bit about the game and knowing how big these guys were on the college level compared to high school, I just, had to set in my mind that I'll be darned if I get hit, by a defensive person. I'd rather do the hitting than be the hit-y.
Right.
So, Missouri was a school that's black and gold, winning colors. My cousin went to school there, and I'm referring to the cousin who got drafted to the Cowboys. He went to Missouri.
Okay.
And he actually came to play against the Redskins in Washington. He played for Dallas, and Dallas came to play the Redskins in the NFC Championship game. 1983, which was my senior year. And I told him, I said, when he came, I said, you got some tickets for me? He's like, yeah, I got tickets. He said, what's going on with you? I said, well, I just took a trip to Wichita State. He was like, Wichita State? Man, you want to go to a real school that's going to be there when you get out of school. You don't want to go to school there, man. He said, tell you what, I'll call you back in a few hours, man. Let me make some phone calls for you. You made some phone calls, got in touch with a East Coast recruiter, and the recruiter called me up that Sunday. I went to the game, saw the game. That Monday, I had an East Coast recruiter give me a call, and, from there, they were like, hey, we're not going to recruit you. We're going to get you, kind of thing.
Right.
And, funny story. I took the trip to Missouri, sat and talked to Warren Powers, and he was like, Eric, we'd love to have you. We know your lineage. We know your roots, and you're originally from St. Louis. We got a lot of support in St. Louis, right? I was like, oh yeah, I got a lot of family here. It's like, well, we can't offer you a scholarship because we've already offered everybody. I kind of came late in the game, late in the recruiting game, And the only way you can get a scholarship, Eric, is if somebody turns one down. So all the rest of the recruits are like, you know, there's that special moment when we're at dinner and then, you know, one recruit goes and talks to the head coach at a time. And he, you know, kind of goes sit in the booth with him. So when you leave the booth, you come back to the table, everybody want to know, well, what'd he say? What'd he say? Did he offer you? You know, they're kind of telling all their business, right? And I know I didn't get an offer. So when I came back to the table, everybody like, what did he say? I was like, hey, none of your business, man. don't worry about me. I'm gonna be all right. Don't worry about what we talked about. I'll let you know, kind of thing. So I felt kind of embarrassed and kind of belittled. But it was about 10 days later, a week and a half later, they called up to the school and offered me a scholarship over the phone.
That's great.
I ended up signing my letter of intent on my mom's birthday, which is Valentine's Day.
Oh, that's a special.
She was right there. So
now your mom was born on Valentine's Day?
You got something in common with somebody else over here. That's wearing your jersey right now.
I was born on Valentine's Day.
Is that right?
And so was my grandmother, yeah.
And so was your grandmother.
That's
wow,
right.
A lot of love going around in February. Huh?
I get a little ignored on Valentine's Day, you know, because it's all about the ladies. And like, that's all right, you know. So it was a nice gift from my mom to her mother at the time. And was your father born in February also?
Yeah, he was born a week later.
There you go. Look at that.
Yep.
And your mom was born in Valentine's Day. That is great. Now, let me ask you another question just to follow up on this recruiting to college, though. Why did they want you to play the D-line? You're only 6'2". You were like a lean build, right? Or what was the story behind that?
Oh, my God. I was coming out of high school. I was 6'1", weighed 180 pounds, soaking wet. And we're talking about I really didn't lift weights that much until my senior year.
Okay.
So, as far as the weight room is concerned, I wasn't very strong.
Right.
And, you know, when I signed my letter of intent, I graduated on June 9th, 1983. And on June 10th, I was at the University of Missouri for picture day. Okay, now it's time to get in the weight room. And I get in the weight room, I'm trying to lift weights. You know, they said, here, strength coach said, here, he gave me a little sheet, said, let's see what you can do. Put two 45 plates, one on each side.
Right.
That's about 135 pounds. Man, that thing, I couldn't move that thing, man. I couldn't even get it off, the bench.
Right.
So, we had to strip that bar down until we just got to the bar. I started with the bar, okay? We had to start with the bar, and they're looking at me like, Jesus Christ, man, what is this cat right here? I don't know about this cat, man. So, you know, and I'm supposed to play defensive end, and at the time it's the Big Eight.
Right.
You know, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Oklahoma State, Colorado.
Big time. Yeah, big time football.
Kansas, man. Iowa State, you know.
Yeah.
You know, this ain't, you know, Rudy Poole football. We're playing with the big boys. And they kind of thought I would get big like my dad, you know, get big like him. But, you know, I didn't make it that far.
Well, that's what I was thinking about asking, if they thought you were just going to grow to be the size of like your father and they were just looking down the line for you like as a junior and senior. Yeah, all right.
Yeah, feed me the steaks and whatnot in the training room and whatnot and kind of beef me up. But I drank all these drinks and I ate the food. Now, the food was good, but I drank all these protein drinks and all it did was keep me in the bathroom.
Right.
So
now did you wind up starting very early as a D-back or was it, you know?
No.
When did you take over the spot?
I redshirted. I was a redshirt.
Right. You redshirted your first year, okay.
You ever hear of a guy named NFL Hall of Famer, Kansas City Chiefs, named Bobby Bell?
Oh, yeah. Bobby Bell was a linebacker for the Chiefs, yeah.
Exactly. Well, Bobby Bell Jr. went to the University of Missouri.
Oh.
He was a defensive end as well.
Okay.
So I kind of gravitated towards Bobby because I figured, you know, he can identify with, you know, my life and some of the things, some of my, you know, idiosyncrasies about being the son of and blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, Bobby was kind of a tweener, you know, kind of in between being a linebacker and kind of in between being, you know, something else, kind of slim build, but able to play, you know, defensive end in a two-point stance and jack up tight ends and run to the flat and cover and rush the passer as well. So when I lined up, you know, as a freshman, you know, and I got redshirted because tight ends were blowing me off the ball 60 yards downfield. You know, I couldn't hold anything, let alone I couldn't even bench press the bar. So they redshirted me. And Bobby would spend time with me after practice every day, okay, for as long as it took until I started to, you know, start building some muscle and be able to jack up these tight ends in practice. And when I started jacking up these tight ends, then he kind of cut me loose. And Bobby was All-American in college. And, you know, I owe a lot to Bobby Bell Jr. for spending time with me and working with me, you know, like that.
Right.
But it wasn't until I was 83, I redshirted 84. Then came the spring of 80, going in 84. And what they said was, we got to get you on the field, because I mean, I used to make a lot of plays in practice by pass dropping and covering tight end. So needless to say, they brought me in on third down as a redshirt freshman, and I covered tight ends. Okay. I covered backs out the backfield. And then depending on if they changed strength, if the tight end moved to one side, then that would automatically make me the pass rusher. Now, I'm going to tell you, those 275-pound, 300-pound linemen, if they got their hands on me, I was finished, all right? But I was so quick off the line that I led the team in sacks.
I led the team
in interceptions. And I covered, you know, I used to cover guys with the likes of Mark Bavaro at Notre Dame, you know, as a redshirt freshman. So, you know, I held my own as a little skinny kid that was building his body up, literally. Right. So,
now the playmaker arrived in your senior year. You had, you know, five picks, but you had three for touchdowns. So now tell us about your senior a little bit and how that might have elevated your draft status, that performance. Like you said, you played in the Big Eight, a lot of big-time colleges. Well, everybody's playing to go to the Orange Bowl and all that. So explain a little bit what went on there.
Well, if you fast forward to the senior year, that's like 1987. But right. I moved to safety in 1985 when they fired Warren Powers and brought Woody Woodenhofer in.
Okay.
And I have to, you know, take you back from 87 to 85 to kind of tell you this part of the story, mm-hmm. which is very significant because it aided in the success that I had as a pro.
Right.
The reason being is I won a slam dunk competition at halftime in one of the Missouri basketball games, and Woody Woodenhofer, the new coach, was there. Woody came from the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was the linebacker coach for Jack Ham and Jack Lambert.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Back during the Steel Curtain days.
Yeah.
So he brought the Pittsburgh Steelers defense and philosophy to Missouri, and we played the Pittsburgh style defense. It was a true 4-3. All right.
Right.
And so they moved me to safety, and I couldn't even backpedal. You know, they had to teach me how to backpedal, and I thank God for the coaches having a little bit of patience with me and teaching me the necessary skills to be successful. And I made lots of mistakes, trust me. I gave up touchdowns too, you know. But getting to my senior year, you know, once I played 2 or 3 years, matter of fact, I made All-American in 1985, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. that was crazy, man. When I saw the final standings at the end of the season, it said Eric McMillan, All-American. I was like, you got to be kidding me. I don't even know what the hell I'm doing. But in 87, I was able to pick off some passes. And that's during the time in which, you know, I was playing strong safety. And if the tight end lined up on my side, I would go to tight end is, or the two receiver side. And if they moved to the other side, I could very easily be the free safety. But that was during the time where I had to cover, as a strong safety, curl to flat. Nowadays, guys just run to the flat, and then they drop a linebacker to the curl.
Right.
But
as a
strong safety in the 4-3, I had to curl and the flat. So if a guy ran to the curl, if the tight end ran to the curl, and then the wide receiver just curled up in the flat, I had to figure out and read quarterback as to which ones he was throwing to. So I used to use my speed and pick off out routes. You don't see too many guys picking off out routes. Not these days. Not unless it's, you know, my good man that wears Gotham Green, number 24, last name Revis.
Right.
Revis does that real well.
Right.
But yeah, I picked up three passes, took them back to touchdowns, and, you know, I did all I can do to help my team win. I matriculated into being a third-round draft pick. Now, if we had a better season, a winning record, maybe I would have been a first-round draft pick. But because we didn't win a lot, who knows what would happen? Who knows what would have happened?
Did you know anything about the Jets when the Jets drafted you in the third round? Like, I mean, you know, did your father give you any advice as well, too?
No. To be honest with you, you know, I used to see the Jets coming in Missouri and watching films. The running back coach, Bobby Hammond, spent a lot of time at Mizzou, coming up there looking at film, and I didn't have any idea. They played me like a fiddle, man, because my roommate was Darrell Wallace. Darrell Wallace in college was he left Missouri as an all-time leading rusher, and I got wind of that. Darrell and Robert Del Pino and Jeff Cross, you know, and all these other guys around America, the Jets had flown them to New York to come check out their facilities and do their own little combine and interview sessions and all like that. They didn't invite me.
All right.
They didn't even invite me. So, you know, I didn't even I had no idea where I was going to get drafted or even if I was going to get drafted. I was just looking for an opportunity.
All right. So, meanwhile, you got drafted in the third round by the Jets in 1988. And later in the third round, James Hasty got drafted also. And
yes,
you guys were cornerstones for the team for a while there. James Hasty, you become quick friends with him when you arrived to the Jets?
Yeah, yeah. When we both got drafted, when they first brought us in for the first mini camp, Hasty was my roommate in the hotel.
Oh, cool.
So I met him in the hotel room. I was like, who are you? Why are you in my room? You know, he's like, who are you? So the first thing you said, he was like, well, you got to know who I am, man. I got drafted the same round as you. I'm 3B. You were 3A. I was like, oh, really? Oh, I didn't even know that. And the reason why I didn't know that was because I was the last player picked on draft on draft day number one. Because they used to do it for – they did it was 2 days.
Right.
And they only got through three rounds of drafting. And when they called my name after they drafted me, they were rolling credits.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so they went off the air. So I didn't even pay attention to what happened, you know, after I got drafted. But anyway, I met Hasty in the hotel room.
Okay.
And, yeah, we became good friends. And we used to live together. We rented out apartments and we rented out a house for the first 2 years in the league. So we were together. We were like Batman and Robin, man. We were Batman and Robin.
That's right. Cool. James Hasty, number 40, another good defensive
back. Oh, yeah.
He was a shutdown corner before they even talking about shutdown corner.
Oh, yeah. No, he was real good. He was real – and the tandem I thought was great. And we're going to take a quick break, Eric, and then when we come back, we're going to start to talk about your career with the Jets. Is that okay?
Right.
All right,
thank
folks.
You,
we're
thank you so
break
much.
Right now, Eric McMillan, sure. Former Jet, is with us. We'll be back, and we'll be talking about his Jet career coming up in the next segment.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back on Sports Talk 1240, our pre-Super Bowl show. The big game's 1 week out. And we have with us the special guest for the evening, Eric McMillan, former New York Jets safety. and one of the big playmakers in NFL history. Although his career may have been short, he was a dominant force right from the get-go. So now we start with your NFL career, Eric. You come to the Jets as a third-round pick. You spoke about your Missouri coach that coached the linebackers with the Pittsburgh Steelers in the Steel Curtain. When you get to the Jets, your defensive coordinator was Bud Carson initially, correct?
That's correct.
All right, so how was it coming into camp and dealing with Bud Carson initially?
Well, Bud was, Bud probably forgot, and God rest his soul, Bud probably forgot more football than anybody will ever know.
Right.
So he took, when he passed away, he took a whole lot of football schemes with him, man.
Yeah.
Because Bud had a defense for every single situation. It just came down to the players playing the doggone thing and making it happen. But, it was pretty competitive. It was very competitive. I had to say my counterpart, Hasty, they made him a starter coming out the box. After the first mini camp, he was cracking the starting lineup, whereas I was like sixth or seventh safety on the list.
All right.
And, Jerry Holmes and Lefty Lyles were still there. Rich Miano was still there. And, before long, they end up releasing all those guys except for Rich Miano and Mike Zordich, were two of the guys that were left over from, the guys who were there before me. And, when I walked in the huddle, I have to tell you now, it wasn't too friendly in that huddle. With all these veterans, you got Gasnol, Marty Lyons, and Klecko had just left. He went to Indianapolis because I think he had he had surgery on his knee, and he was able to get signed by Indianapolis. But they end up starting all rookies in the secondary. So, they're like, doggone, they're starting all rookies. They're going to be throwing this ball. But what actually led to my success as a Jet defensive back early on was that Bud was playing the same defense that I had been playing for 3 years at Missouri.
Right.
I didn't have anything new to learn. The only thing I had to learn was, if we, cover three, we had a different name for it. I just had to learn names. If I could remember the names, then I'd just get out there and play ball. I wasn't thinking. I was just reading and reacting.
Right.
Getting out there making plays. So that's what enabled me to come in and just kind of do what I did. Because it was all natural. I wasn't thinking, I wasn't worried about nothing. And a lot of times I changed defense if I thought we had something that would work better. I just had to communicate it to my middle linebacker, Kyle Clifton and Joe Kelly. And if they got the call, we'd make the adjustment and let's go to work,
All right, now in 1988, the season starts. I was at your first home game, which was where you had your first interception. I'll never forget the game because, one, the Jets blew out the Houston Oilers, 45-3. Do you remember your first interception?
You remember that. Yeah, you remember it. You were there. You remember that.
I was at the game, yeah. It was me and my dad sitting in the upper deck, and it was an annihilation of the Oilers. And the Oilers were a good team at the time. I mean, the Jets.
Oh, yeah, they were good.
Yeah, the Jets went 8-7-1 that year, but you clearly should have been at least 10-6. You blew two games against the Kansas City Chiefs. You had one tie, and you lost to them in Kansas City. But that was a really good Jet team. Tell us about your first interception, though, because I remember being there for it.
First interception. It was actually an overthrow. I think it was, Warren Moon was the quarterback, but Warren didn't play that game. I think it was Cody Carlson, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And he tried to hit somebody over the middle or right outside the hash marks. And I went to where the receiver was, and I was like, that ball ain't going to make it to him. It's going to go over his head. So I readjusted my pass. And got in the path on the football and zeroed in on it, picked it off. And once I caught it, I was like, uh-oh, now what are we going to do? But I caught the ball and started running down the sideline, and I see all these big linemen coming my way. I was like, yeah, I think I'm out of space here. I think I'm going to just tap out right here without sound.
I remember, and I was also, you actually had a pick in a game. You had to remember this game because it was warm out, but it was just torrential downpours when you played the Chiefs at home. The game wound up being a 17-17 tie. And I'll be honest with you, the reason why I remember this game being a tie was you guys were in field goal range, not too far. I don't think it would have been any more than a 30-yard kick. And I remember Joe Walton running the ball like one more time just to get maybe a few extra yards or center it for the kick or whatever it was going to be. And I think it was McNeil. I'm pretty sure. I'm not positive. But I think it was McNeil wound up fumbling the ball and Casey took possession. The game wound up ending in a 17 tie. You have to have remembered that game.
To be honest with you, I remember certain things in that game, and I'm still asking myself to this day, how did we end up with a tie in pro football?
Right.
I don't remember how that happened, but no, I don't remember the fumble, to be honest with you.
Right.
You know, usually with me, you know, if we go out there and lose a game,
right,
I throw it out of my memory so quick, and right, I don't commit it to memory.
Yep.
As a defensive back, you got to have a short memory, and I kind of, you know, took that stance. You know, if I go out there and blow a play, I kind of, you know, I memorize it, then I forget it and toss it out my mind, and you know, one of those kind of deals. But I do remember playing in those games, but I don't remember, you know, the fumble and or the reason why, you know, we came up short on points.
A lot of times that stuff sticks more with a diehard fan because he lives week to week with his team. But you know, that was the beginning of a big season for EMAC, all right? Defensive Rookie of the Year, 1988 for the NFL. 8 interceptions, 2 touchdowns on interceptions also. I was there for your first one. It was in a loss to the Buffalo Bills in a home game. But the bigger game was the week after that Buffalo loss. You went down to Miami, and this became, you know, the beginning of the assault on Dan Marino. You had a lot of interceptions against Dan Marino. In this particular game, you had 3 picks, and you had your first interception for a touchdown against Dan Marino because you did it later on in your career also. Do you remember that game? It was a 44-30 win down in Miami. You remember that one? Because that was a big one, especially at that point in the season because you were still in playoff contention, you know, halfway through.
Well, I actually do remember that game.
You have to. You had the hat trick, man. You liked hockey. You had the hat trick. Not many times you see a guy with 3 picks in a game, no less a big interception return for a touchdown, and to make those kind of picks against a Dan Marino, a Hall of Fame quarterback.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, though, you know, because, like I said, you know, my perspective on the whole professional athlete thing was, you know, far different than someone who's never been there.
Right.
I never been into names. I never been into status.
Right.
I never been into, you know, who's who and who you're supposed to respect because I view myself as such a – I'm a competitive dude, and I don't care what your resume looks like. You still got to compete against me, and I got to compete against you, and then we got to battle, and I got to win. So we're sitting in meetings the week of going to Miami to play against the Dolphins, and I remember Wally Chambers, the D-line coach, he was sitting next to me, and Hasty was sitting on my left, and Wally was sitting on my right. We're watching film, and everybody's talking about Marino this, Marino that. And I'm like, who the hell is Marino?
Right.
and Hasty turned around and looked at me, he's like, hey, wait a minute. You don't know who Marino is? I was like, who is this cat? He's the quarterback. Wally Chambers looked at me and he said, are you going to find out on Sunday who he is? I was like, shh, man, come on. I ain't worried about this guy, man. I ain't worried about this dude. The guy looks right where he's throwing. You know, to Marino's credit, he was a great quarterback. He's a great man. He was a great quarterback. He looked right where he was throwing, but the cat had an arm. He had an arm like a gun, and he could thread the needle if he wanted to. But he never met a safety like me. He never met a safety who had speed like me that I can cover ground from 0 to 60 in 4.28 seconds.
Right.
Okay? That's what I like to hear.
He never seen that. So when those balls were coming, and all of a sudden, all he saw was that Gotham Green flash, take a lick, beep, see ya.
You know, the reason I focus on particular games and the stats you put up is, I mean, anybody can do this research. Now, I understand your career was shorter than guys like Ronnie Lott or Rod Woodson or Kenny Houston, some other great names, Hall of Famers out there. But I couldn't find a guy. Kenny Houston was the only guy that put up as many touchdowns in his first 4 years as you did. Anybody else, you go that – it doesn't matter, Deion Sanders – any big-time speed, instinctive corner, safety, nobody really did the kind of things you did. And you had the 2 fumble recoveries. That's why I like to focus on this because, for me, when I was a kid, and John also, Darrell Ray was a great safety for the Jets in the early 80s. And he had a similar type start to his career as you did. But yours was, I mean, listen, NFL defensive rookie of the year. If it wasn't your rookie year, you probably would have made first team all pro. I think you made at least first or second team all pro your second year when you made the Pro Bowl again. And, this rookie year was big for the Jets because I saw the makings of a great defense with you and Hasty being added in the defensive backfield. So I know my partner wanted to ask you maybe a little bit about Mark Gastineau because he wanted retiring. Talk to him about Mark Gastineau a little bit.
Yeah, well, Gastineau, we were big fans of Gastineau at the time, you know. And we still are a little bit. But the thing, I have a sour taste in my mouth a little bit. But the Gastineau, that year in 88 when he left in the middle of the year, did he guys address the team and at least you guys on the defense and tell you why he was leaving or anything like that?
No. As a team, no, we didn't. We didn't really talk about it too much. You know, Joe Walton made an announcement.
Right.
And, you know, he made an announcement at the meeting, and everybody just kind of, you know, got together in the locker room and kind of fished around to see what the story was. And, you know, we got the story. But, you know, Gastineau didn't have too many friends, you know, on the team for whatever reason. And I have no idea because I wasn't there. I was in college.
Right.
But I'll tell you, Mark was a good friend to me, and I loved Mark. I love Mark for many reasons. I can tell you one, looking at Mark Gastineau, he was a human specimen. This cat was physically intimidating.
Right.
Just by looking at him, man. The cat was ripped. I was like, this is a big dude.
Yeah.
And he is cut. You know, he had the long hair going and whatnot. And, you know, he likes to do a little sack dance.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You know,
as right kids, we loved him.
As kids, we loved him. You know, he's slamming the quarterback down, doing a dance over him.
He was dynamic.
Yeah, so.
Eric, he is one of the greatest football players in Jets history. He is still ranked as one of the top pass rushers of all time, in the top 10 with Reggie White, all these other guys. Him and Reggie White are the only guys to win the sack title back-to-back years. He's the only guy to have 40-plus sacks in two consecutive years. I mean, he's the only guy I know that made All-Pro first team as much as he did, and he's never even been considered for the Hall of Fame. I'm sure if the Jets had won a Super Bowl, that might have been different, but he created a lot of enemies along the way. You don't have to mince words. We know. I mean, we still loved him because he was the straw for that team in the early 80s. He was what made that team tick, and everybody was worried about Gastineau and where he was coming from, everybody.
I really wish I could have played a full season behind him before he left. And, you know, I kind of felt betrayed, you know, that he left, you know, in the middle of the season. But, you know, the cat had damn near 8 sacks in the first 5 weeks of the season.
I know.
Yeah,
I mean, that's, you know, exactly what you said. That's how I felt too. But I felt betrayed as a Jet fan because, you know, we bleed green over here, you know, and especially my idol, you know, my first jersey was Gastineau when I was a kid. I was just like, this was like, you know, but, you know, I still love him. I still love the Jets. I still love you guys.
Did it disrupt the dynamic in the locker room when he left? Did you feel anything like that, or did you guys just carry on just fine?
Well, me being a rookie, I'm focused on too much. I didn't worry about the gossip. I wasn't into the gossip. I wasn't into the who is who and what is what. But, you know, it did hurt me personally because, you know, I spent probably more time than a whole lot of my other teammates. I spent time talking to Mark. I would talk to Mark. I would, you know, kind of pick his brain. You know, I'd sit at the lunch table and eat with him, you know, whereas he ain't had too many friends, you know. I can't emphasize that enough.
Yeah.
But,
no, we know all about it. You don't have to.
Yeah.
We know.
Yeah.
I know.
You know, I can't emphasize that enough. But, you know, I liked Mark. Mark was good with me. And you can't knock a man for falling in love either, man, because, you know, he fell in love with a Hollywood star. He fell in love with Bridget Nielsen.
Yeah, right.
And, she used to come around a lot. You know, she used to come around and appear in places where she really had no business being. You know, she was pretty much a distraction. She was a distraction to me. I can say that. I'm only going to speak for myself,
right?
My teammates. But she was a distraction for me, and you know, she was always around, and he loved her, and you know, you can't knock a man. He fell in love, and he said, you know, I'm going to choose a different life. I don't need to play football anymore, and I'm going to hang up my shoes. You know, I really wish he didn't. I really wish he hadn't made that choice, but he made that choice, and you know, I still got to go to work every day. So
yeah,
you know. We just had to move on.
Yeah, you know what? The one thing I will say in Gastineau's defense is he didn't remain, like, pig-headed. He was very remorseful. You know, when he talks to kids nowadays, he tells them about not being like he was as a young guy in his early 20s.
Right, yeah.
And he is remorseful about what went on. He's not like one of those kind of guys looking for like a reality TV show. Although his wife and one of his daughters got a reality show, but he's been actually removed. He's more religious now. So at least he's not as brash and outspoken as some guys do remain, even despite doing the wrong thing as a player during their career. So I'll give him that much at least.
Yeah, well, you know, life has a way of humbling you. Yeah. You know, whenever you assume, you know, the spotlight, you know, playing as an athlete, you know, you're playing on that stage. You know, if you don't handle yourself accordingly or handle yourself with a little bit of, you know, poise or class or, you know, you don't be kind to people, you know, in the community and such, you know, life has a way and karma has a way of coming back around and educating you, so to speak.
Right.
So, you know, that's just life, man.
Yeah, no, I know.
That's the way it is.
Now, okay, so now the five interceptions in your career for touchdowns, and that's still the all-time record for the Jets. And you have the most total touchdowns because you had two fumble recoveries in 1989 to go along
really?
With your one touchdown. I was at that game. They lost the game, but your interception went 92 yards back to the house, gave the Jets a 10-0 lead in that game. My cousin, who was here earlier to drop off the jersey, he actually went to the game. He still remembers the game. Do you remember that interception in that game against the Colts?
Yeah, that was against the Colts. And I tell you, we had a defensive back coach and a defensive coordinator named Ralph Hawkins that year.
Right.
And Ralph was, I think Ralph came from the Seattle Seahawks. And Ralph was, he was my coach in the Senior Bowl when I played in the Senior Bowl. So he knew a little bit about me. And he kind of played with me. You know, he had a good sense of humor, but he was kind of serious at the same time, to tell you a short story.
Right.
So after that game, you know, I pick up the pass, ran a touchdown. So on Monday, we come in, we're looking at the film, and everybody was like, yeah, let me see how, you know, they know the play is coming up, okay, on the film. So when it's time for the play to be shown, Ralph speeds up the film and kind of fast forward through it so nobody's seen it. Nobody could see it. And everybody turned around like, hey, run that back, man, run that back. And he just fast forwarded. And he's kind of like saying, I'm not going to show it to you, Eric, because you didn't deserve to get that kind of thing. So you know, but on that particular play, we had a blitz on. We had a safety blitz on, and everybody was in man coverage except for one guy. And it was the safety that was on the left side. And when the number two receiver went in motion from that side over to the opposite side of the football, the other side of the field, he wasn't supposed to go. His blitz was supposed to be off, and he was supposed to fall back in coverage. But I, you know, when that guy went in motion, I looked over and I was like, I was saying something to him. You know, I was trying to give him the code name for the call to say, hey, don't blitz. And I said, damn, this dude is gone. Which means if that back came out to that side, he was going to be wide open. And when I saw him going, I was like, you know what? Let me get my read. Eric Dickerson was in the backfield, and he blocked. He was the guy that I was covering. So since I saw him block, I immediately ran over to the other side of the football field, and I said, this guy, and I saw the guy coming wide open, and I said, you know what? If he throws his ball, it's Heidi Ho. I'm gone. And he threw the ball. Pick a lick. See ya.
Yeah, I remember you cutting right in front, and you were down the sideline. I mean,
so,
it was so exciting.
So basically, Coach Ralph Hawkins was like, Eric, what were you doing over there? You know, that kind of thing. And I was like, well, you know, the ball, I mean, they're about to score. You know, they're inside the 10-yard line.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, either we make a play or, you know, it's 6 points. My guy blocks. So if my guy blocks, then I don't have a responsibility other than to find the football. Well, guess what, Coach? I went to find the football, and I knew where it was going.
Yeah.
And that's where I went.
You were something else, I tell you. In terms of reading the quarterback and the instincts and the reaction, you know, you know, my dad always talked about this, that first two steps, you can't teach that. The explosion in the first two or three steps for an athlete, that's what makes the difference from high school to college and then high school to the pros when it comes to those kind of positions, especially defensive back. And you can't teach that. You know, you can work on speed all you want with a speed coach. You might shave off a tenth of a second, maybe two tenths if you're real good in your work ethic. But those first two, three strides, that explosion, you can't teach that. That's God given, and speed kills. You know the slogan, and you used it to the fullest. So now here's the problem. Your defensive rookie of the year in the NFL in 1988. you're a Pro Bowler. Second year, Pro Bowler again, all pro. Now 1990 comes, and now we got a coaching change. Joe Walton is fired, and Bruce Coslin is hired. And now your new defensive coordinator is Pete Carroll.
Right.
So how was it originally when Pete Carroll came in to run the defense?
Man, I love Pete. I love Pete to this day. Matter of fact, I try to keep in touch with Pete as much as I can.
Uh-huh.
When he was at USC, you know, coaching, I flew out to California, and I didn't call him. I didn't call him, make an announcement. I just dropped in on him, man. And he was sitting in the film room watching film with his guys, man. And, you know, he stopped the film session, and we went back in his office. We sat and talked for a little while and got caught up on a few things, you know, a couple of years, you know, worth of conversation. And, you know, Pete was really good to me, man. I had no problems with any of those coaches except Coslin. Okay.
Right.
Coslin and Dick Steinberg, and God rest his soul, okay, because he's no longer with us either.
Yep.
But Coslin had it in for me, man. And, you know, some guys you like, some guys you didn't like. I would guess I was one of those guys he didn't like.
Right.
And, you know, the reason why, you know, I read the internet one time, you know, somebody made a post about, they asked the question, you know, why was McMillan's career so short? And then somebody typed up a response by saying, I think he had knee problems. Well, I didn't have any knee problems. I didn't have any injuries.
Right.
The only thing that got hurt on me was my pride. And the reason why that my career was cut short was because of politics, okay? And I'll tell you, you know, I went to graduate school. I enrolled in graduate in Fordham University. I enrolled in graduate school right after my first season
right.
as a Jet.
Yeah, while you were with the Jets, yep.
You know, I went to Hawaii for the Pro Bowl. I came back a week later. I was enrolled at Fordham, taking, you know, graduate courses, working on my master's in education administration.
Yep,
that's fantastic. Yeah.
By the time Coslin came, I had two classes left. Okay, and I was taking courses during the season. I was taking courses in the off season as well. I finished up in 2 years, but I had two classes left, and the last class was in May. Mini camp wasn't until like May 15th. Well, we had graduation on like May 9th. Coursework was over like on May 9th. Graduation was like May 27th. Mini camp was in between the 9th and the 27th of the month of May 1990, 1991. Okay.
Yep.
So there were no mandatory practices. Bruce came to the Jets, you know, with all these Cincinnati Bengals players he wanted to bring in
right.
as free agents or whatever the case may be. But there was only, what, three or four of us that lived in New York in the offseason. There's Eric McMillan, Free McNeil, Wesley Walker, and Marty Lyons. Okay, those okay. only four guys that were on the team that lived in New York in the offseason.
Right.
Everybody else lived all over the country. And Dick Steinberg and Bruce Coslin said, hey, we want you to come in and work with the guys between 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was like, well, I can't. You know, I got class, you know, between 10 and 2. Greg McCready's was the strength coach, and he stayed there till 7 in the evening. So I go to class between 10 and 2, and then, you know, it took me about an hour 15, hour and 20 minutes to drive from Manhattan back to Long Island after class, and I'd work out between 3 and 7.
Right.
We're talking about lifting weights, we're talking about stretching, we're talking about doing some conditioning, running. We're not sitting in there drawing X's and O's.
Right.
Yeah, right.
There's no other guys in there. These are random guys. These guys are not even my teammates yet.
Right.
So I can care less about them. Hell, they're trying to audition to get my job for all I know.
Yep.
But, you know, so since I was defiant about not coming and working out with the guys because they told me to, they decided to put me on the bench. Okay, so I asked the general public, you know, I asked this question now.
Right.
Are you serious about winning? You're going to take your best player. You're going to take, you know, I'm just calling a spade a spade. I'm not trying to be confident or cocky or anything like that. I'm just stating the facts.
Right.
You take your all-pro player and you're putting them on the bench. Are you really trying to win or are you just trying to sell tickets? You know, what are you really trying to do?
Right.
Okay. They didn't have a job for me. Okay, and Pete, you know, I used to go, you know, I would watch film and then go into the coach's office just to, you know, talk to Pete because I had a question about something I saw or what kind of call would I make in this situation, and we sit down and talk about it.
Right.
And Pete told me face-to-face, man-to-man, And there's other coaches in the room, but, well, not at that moment, there were no other coaches in the room. And he told me, hey, Costa got it in for you, man. There's nothing I can do about it. I can't do anything about it. And he's coordinator and defensive back coach.
Right, and he's being told what to do, is what you're telling me.
Right. Exactly. So he's telling me, he's like, E, you're being real professional about it, man. Keep studying the way you're studying, and, you know, if a situation comes up, you know, when we can use you, man, I'm going to support you. I'm going to put you in.
Right.
You know, he told me straight up, face-to-face, just like that. But it wasn't his call. You know, it was on, you know, Steinberg and Coughlin. So 8 interceptions the first year, 7 interceptions the next year, 6 interceptions the following year. You know why my interceptions are going down?
Because you're playing time and snaps.
No, I was playing. Who the hell is going to throw the ball down the middle when I'm picking off, taking it back to 6?
Well, obviously teams are going to, you know, when they go into their weekly game plans, they're going to say, okay, where's number 22? But when you first this coaching change was made, did they force you to win your job back? Is that what in actuality happened? Is that what?
No. When they first got there, I was the starter.
Okay.
And they had no problem with that. They had no problem with that coming out the box. That was 1990.
Right, 90.
1991, when I was about to graduate, and I had 2 classes in the offseason.
The second year with the Jets. Okay, with them. Okay, I got you.
Yeah, that was their second year as a coach.
Right,
staff.
Right, as a coach's staff, yes.
They wanted me to come work out with the guys.
Right.
And I was like, no, I'm not doing it between 10 and 2. You know, I'm going to come work out with whoever's left.
Yeah, but you're in school.
There, between 3 and 7.
Right.
Okay, that's what I'm going to do because I'm going to finish up this degree.
Yeah.
This is mine to get, and I'm going for it. So
because that is odd because they only started you 6 games or something like that year, right? Something like that. That is odd how it dropped off like that and you're having such a great career.
Well, no, it's not odd. It's out of respect. Okay, when you the first year in the league, they started all rookies in the secondary. So naturally, everybody's going to throw it. They're all rookies because we're unproven players.
Right.
So I finished up with 8 interceptions. I can't tell you how many balls I deflected, and how many balls I got my hands on that weren't.
Right, balls defended or knocked down in pass coverage. Yeah,
right. You were having a great career.
Watched you. You were lightning out of the bottle. You were right out of the game.
It's just weird that how he would drive, I can see what you're saying with the coaching, yeah.
You look at Revis.
Yeah.
Revis doesn't get a lot of interceptions.
Of course.
You know, in a year.
You're the same situation. The same situation with you.
Right.
Okay, so it's the same kind of thing. But I led the team in interceptions. If I had 5 interceptions, that's 5 more than anybody else had on that squad. So what they told the media was, well, McMillan's performance is going down. His interceptions are going down, and, you know, we just feel that – and no disrespect to Lonnie Young at all. Lonnie and I were just together at the Senior Bowl last week, and Lonnie and I talk a lot during the season. He's a scout with the Ravens. We became best friends. The media tried to pit us against each other, but – it never got to that point. You know, Lonnie and I are friends for life. But they brought Lonnie in and gave him my job. And they said Lonnie Young was a better free safety than Eric McMillan. Okay, well, that's cool. But they gave me a new contract. Did y'all know that?
Yeah, I knew that.
Yeah.
They tore up my first contract. I signed a 3 years and an option coming out of college.
Right.
88 Pro Bowl, 89 Pro Bowl, played out in 1990, and then – in 91, they gave me they tore up my contract and gave me a brand new contract.
Right.
And named me as the captain, one of the captains, and put me on the bench.
You were the best defensive player they had.
Yeah.
I mean,
now you tell me, where's the logic in that?
Doesn't make any sense.
There was no logic. Even in 1991, I remember because I followed the team religiously. Right. You started out the season, you got a cheap home win, you know, you beat the Buccaneers 16-13. The team lost 3 games in a row. You lost this is what I mean, like, my feelings on Cousin aren't just about you. I didn't like the way he treated Ken O'Brien at the end. But you lost 3 games in a row, and you may not remember this, but I remember it. It was a Monday night game against the Bears. The Jets had no business losing it, and Pat Leahy was hurting with his back. He missed like a 20-some-odd-yard field goal. And you guys, first of all, the Bears tied it at the end of regulation, and then Leahy missed a chip shot. You lose that game in overtime. The team's 1-3. The next game was the last assault on Dan Marino. You had another big interception for a touchdown. Otherwise, you'd probably lose that game, too. I mean, that was a huge game to turn around the season. I don't get it.
You got to understand and don't miss this, okay? How did I get on the field? Do you remember that?
No, because now we're going back far. I mean, I'm just watching the game waiting for you to be on the field at that point.
Okay. How did I get on the field? Because first, when I went to the bench, they have a job for me. Then they made me return kicks. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, I told you back when I was coming out of high school, I don't like to get hit. So now I'm being put in a very vulnerable position.
Yeah.
I got to return kicks with Terrence Mathis. Well, guess what? I led the AFC East in kickoff return yardage. Okay. Led the AFC East in kickoff return yards until they stopped kicking to me. They started kicking to Terrence and making me block,
right.
So, which was fine. I was fine with that. As long as we're winning, I'm good.
Right.
My only job became kickoff coverage and punt block and punt return. I played all special. They made me a special teamer. I was one of the best special teamers in the AFC East by statistics alone, not by my opinion, by the statistics. I led the team in tackles. I had more tackles on kickoff coverage than Steve Tasker did. Steve Tasker went to the Pro Bowl every year for his special team efforts. So I led the AFC East in kickoff return yards and special team tackles. During that time, the players in the league voted for who goes to the Pro Bowl, not the fans.
Right.
So when the players vote, that's out of respect. Okay, and the only way you can get respect from one player to another is you got to do some work. You got to be better than most. Okay, for people to vote for you, and your name's got to be on the ballot. Okay, but you know, at the end of the season, my name wasn't on the ballot, so nobody can vote for me.
Yeah, I'm sure that was no accident, right?
That wasn't no accident either. So, you know, I say all of this to say, you know. I bleed Gotham Green, man.
Right.
I bleed Gotham Green. You know, I love the Jets. Always have.
Right.
I was a little bit bitter.
I don't blame
you. When I left, and I didn't cause a problem. You know, with in the locker room. You know,
right.
I kept my umbilical cord attached to my teammates. I didn't say a word.
Right.
You know, not until after I left and went and I signed a contract with the Philadelphia Eagles, and I went over there with Bud Carson.
Yeah, I loved Bud Carson when he ran the Jets.
Yeah, me too.
The guy was great.
Unfortunately, it didn't work out for me over there, but, you know, I signed a contract with them. And, you know, then I made some choice comments about, I mentioned the statement about the Jets in my statements, but that's not what I meant. I should have directed my comments strictly at Carson.
Yeah, you know what? You should have, because I was not a fan of Coslitz at all. But before we continue, we just got to pause 1 second for station ID. All right? Hold on.
All right.
1240 WGBB, Freeport.
All right. Thank you, Eric. Now, listen, you know, I was aware of the situation that went on with you, not as in-depth, because I don't think they were covering it as much as it was just apparent when you got to I remember in 1990, after the 91 season, I mean, you guys made the playoffs. You had that big win against Miami at the end of the regular season where Raul Legre had two big field goals to get you in. And I remembered the playoff game against the Oilers. Jets had a good chance to win. You actually had your only playoff game. You had a postseason interception. I remember there was a lot of turnovers down by the goal line, fourth down situations, and the Jets, you know, you squandered a lot of points. You lost 17-10. The next season, to me, like I said, I personally, as a McMillan fan, didn't think your issue was covered enough in the media. The thing with O'Brien was just painfully obvious. Now, before 92, I remember he was due for a contract, and they didn't sign him. They might not have even signed him till the season started or right before, because that was the way they handed the job to Browning Nagel. This is before they gave his number away to Boomer Esiason before the 93 season. You were already gone at that point. But
right.
I saw more go on, or I was just more aware of stuff with Ken O'Brien because it was just right there because the quarterback, the position, and the coverage and all that. But I was annoyed with stuff that the lack of respect that went on towards him and the stuff that went on you. I just didn't understand it because, to me, you were the best defender on the team.
Oh, yeah.
And on the field. So, you know, a lot of what you're saying clears a lot up and makes a lot of sense. I wasn't a big fan of Coslet, and obviously you judge coaches' wins and losses, but I remember not being happy with him right away after 91 because you guys made the playoffs. You know, you had a tight game with the Oilers. There's nothing really to be aggravated with, but that offseason, you know, there wasn't as much coverage with you. That offseason leading into the next season in 92, which wound up being a waste of a season. They went 4-12, and it was too late by the time O'Brien got into the lineup. So it was almost like he didn't like O'Brien and didn't want him as his quarterback. I know Steinberg drafted Brian Nagel, and they almost, like, you know, structured and orchestrated something to get what they wanted, and it truly backfired on him. And then he got to bring in his golden boy from Cincinnati in Boomer Esiason, and that whole thing with giving his number, you know, giving Kenny O'Brien's number 7 to him before he even was released from the team was just another example to me of what went on with you before. You know, the things happened to you a lot more before things started happening to Ken O'Brien. Were you aware of that kind of stuff also with Coslin and O'Brien?
I wasn't paying too much attention to it. To be honest with you, I never really paid attention to, you know, guys and their contracts. I was only looking at my situation and trying to, you know, I gotta tell you, and tell all my fans out there, if I got any fans left out there, man,
I bit my tongue,
and it was hard, man. It was hard for me not to say anything because I knew I was being screwed, and you know, I could have been that village idiot in a locker room and say, you know, trade me, cut me, or, you know, be that village idiot. But I didn't want to be that guy,
right?
You know, because I wanted to take, you know, the better road,
right,
the higher road, if I can find one. And you know, I just said, I just sit here and, you know, but going back to what you said earlier, you said, you know, you saw me come in and make some plays, you know, later on in the season. Well, that's because, you know, my replacement got hurt.
Right.
And my replacement hurt. I forgot what week it was. We went to Detroit to play against the Lions.
Yep.
And it turned into the old E-Mac show. You know, they started dropping back passing, and the next thing they know, they were chasing me down the field. Okay?
Right.
So, you know, I had to prove it to myself. And I had to prove to my teammates, you know, first and foremost, because they're the ones that, you know, believe in me, and as well as me believing in myself, that I hadn't lost any skills, that, you know, I am the same guy. And the interception that meant the most to me was my very last interception as a Jet in the Meadowlands. I picked off Marino again. It was for 83 yards. And I still got the video clip on my highlight reel.
Right.
And the reason why it was so significant, because I had been sitting on the bench all season, and then, you know, I started getting some playing time because we're playing a run and shoot offense, like you said, against Houston.
Yep.
And Lonnie and I were both playing, okay? And but when I picked off this pass against Miami, the game was already decided. We were up by probably 2 or 3 scores at this time. And I picked the pass off, running for 83 yards, and the camera cuts to the sideline. Would you believe there's not one Jet teammate on that sideline? Everybody's down in the end zone with me, partying with me in the end zone,
right,
because they knew what it was. It's kind of like they were in pain, too, and they were happy for me, you know, to get in the game, number one, let alone make another play like that. And, I mean, we were screaming and howling and dancing and cutting up in the end zone, man. It was even the ball boys were down there. Okay, it's on film, man.
Yeah, they were aware of what was going on. They I remember the game because it was after that horrific loss to the Bears in overtime. It was a huge win at 1-3. You needed that win, and it wound up being crucial. I know it was, you know, it made the score 41-23 was the final, whatever it was, and it was in the fourth quarter. But, hey, Dan Marino could strike at any time. So it was still a huge pick to me as a fan because the Jets needed that win, and ultimately that's what gave you the chance to make the playoffs, because beating Miami at the end of the year in overtime, you guys had the same record, but you wound up beating them twice, and that's how you made the playoffs. That was a huge win. That's why I remembered that.
Yeah, so, and you're right.
And that's
right.
a great story.
I just wanted to touch on that because you mentioned it.
Yeah, teammates might not say anything, but they're aware of what goes on. So, you know, maybe more was written about the O'Brien situation, and people were aware of that too later on. But when your situation was going on, like you said, everyone's down in the end zone celebrating. Listen.
The teammates loved you.
I understand you didn't have the lengthy career of Deion Sanders or Rod Woodson or Ronnie Lott, but for a first 4 years of a career, you know, you started getting screwed around with, in that time period, one of the most dominant playmakers the game ever had, and nobody acknowledges it. And that's why we wanted to do this interview, to bring everybody, you know, get everybody in line and realize, especially Jet fans. I don't know any Jet fan. If they don't remember you and your dominance as a playmaker, then they're just ignoring the facts. That's how I look at that. It was impactful. As big a defensive back as Darrell Revis is, okay, he's still not the kind of playmaker that you were. He's a great cover guy, He's got great footwork and all that.
Hey, that boy Revis is something special.
No, he is. Listen, I ain't saying he's not. I'm not saying.
That boy
but there's
special,
a difference
man.
Between being a great D-back and making big plays pass defense. There was something magical in what you did with the football after you picked it off. You know, and guys that showed that in their career are the guys like a Charles Woodson or Eric Allen had one magical year or a Ronnie Lott early in his career was like that.
Right.
It doesn't come around too often. So I wanted to ask you, now, that 90 season when they changed the uniforms around, Brad Baxter was a rookie on the team in 90-91.
Yeah.
I viewed him as a fan of his. I viewed him as the hardest hitter on the team. Was that true? Did you see that in training camps and practice?
Man, when Brad came to us, if I'm not mistaken, from the Minnesota Vikings. He came from the Vikings, or he came from the University of Minnesota. One of the two came out of Minnesota somewhere.
Right. He was drafted by the Vikings, but started with the Jets.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. So I distinctly remember, man. He came to the team, and Bud Carson was there. All right. And they gave the ball to Brad in practice, and Brad was just running through our defense. I'm talking about, like, in practice, we don't really hit anybody. You know, we don't hit the defensive backs. We don't hit the running backs, hit the receivers and knock them down. We just put hands on them and let them keep running, right?
Right.
Brad comes running through the line like it's a game tempo. So we get back in the huddle. I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. What's up with this? Marty Lyons is like, hey, man, who is this cat?
Right. Bud
Carson comes in the huddle. He's like, who is this beep, beep, beep running through my defense like that? I'll tell you what, if that beep, beep, beep starts running through this defense like that again, you better light him up.
Yeah.
So Brad gave the ball to Brad again. Poor Brad, man. Well, we was hitting him so hard it sounded like popcorn.
Right.
We were knocking it. We was hitting him real hard, but the cat wasn't falling down.
Yeah.
Brad Baxter, number 30, was a load. He was a load. This dude could not be knocked down. If he didn't want to go down, he was not going down. I was like, this dude, he need to be in the lineup.
Yeah.
Short yardage, goal line, you better put him in. Hey, Brad was a load, man. And from that day, I had respect for that kid, man. I said, this kid ought to be able to stick around here and get some playing time because this dude ain't going down.
He hit like a truck.
And he's got an edge about him. He's got a mental psyche about him that says I'm going to do some damage.
Right.
And that's the kind of player we needed. And yes, sir, Brad Baxter was a load.
Let me tell you a story about Brad because this is a true story. When I played college hockey, and I couldn't get my number that I wanted for the team, and I couldn't get a few numbers I was looking at, and I actually wound up taking number 30. One because I was a big Bernard King fan when he played for the Knicks. And I took 30 because it was Brad Baxter's number, and he hit, and I was a big body checker, you know, like a power type forward in hockey, and I just loved the way he hit. So the story I want to tell you, because you talked about your academics and going for graduate school while you were on the Jets, that you lived in this area, and I believe that you didn't go out, because I never ran into you when I was in college, and we used to go out and occasionally we'd run into the Jets, different players, all right.
So me
and a couple of my cousin. We go out one night to Spratt's in Westbury, and we're walking in, and there's a big Bronco truck parked right in front.
So Red Bronco.
Yeah. The plate says Jets 30, right? So I had a few drinks so far. I was having a good time. I'm a happy guy when I drink. That's fine. So I look at the truck, and I'm like, Jets 30. I'm like, and now I'm just yelling as I'm heading to the place. I don't see Brad Baxter. I don't see anybody, right? Just talking to my cousin. I'm like, Jets 30. I'm like, there's only one 30. That's Brad Baxter, right? So all of a sudden, I look to my right, and there's Brad Baxter with this gorgeous girl. And I'm like, forget the girl. I'm like, hey, I'm like, you're Brad Baxter. I'm like, man, I just watched you last weekend high-stepping into the end zone against New England. I said, you put that game away with authority. You just hit like a truck out there. You know, so I rolled off a few things a long time ago. I'm going back 25 years or so. But he knew I was telling the truth, and he knew I was a big Jet fan. So he's like, man, he's like, come with me. So he goes to the back of his truck. He has this briefcase in the back of his Bronco, and he opens it up. He goes, I only have one of these left, but I got to give it to you because he knew I was drinking, but I was accurate in everything I was saying about his career up to that point. And I was like, you're the best, man. We gave a little hug. It was a great, great experience. Running into him was one of the best moments of my life, just being out on a Saturday night. It was really a lot of fun. So I wanted to tell you that story because he was a great guy.
Yeah, man, Brad's a great guy, man, great kid. He's got that million-dollar infectious smile, too, man, and you can't help but like a guy, you know, that's always smiling, very nice, very generous, and, you know, very approachable kid, man.
Right.
And he's a hell of a football player, too, no doubt.
Do you still keep in touch with Brad or any of the other Jets?
You know, Brad is like a triple agent, man. Brad changes his phone number so much, man. Every time I get a number, it's a bad number, man. So I heard he's living somewhere. He's still in New York somewhere, but I haven't been able to catch up with him.
He's hiding. Maybe it's because of all those women he dated back then, now that I think about it.
I wish I could run into him from time to time more often, but right. No, I don't get to see Brad that much.
Is there anybody from those teams that you do keep in touch with?
Yeah, John Booty is probably one of my best friends in life. I keep in touch with John Booty. I talked to Rich Miano. I talked to Rich a lot. He's in Hawaii. And let's see, I talked to Namath a lot. I talked to Bobby Jackson. Talked to him probably 2-3 times a month. And I talked to Marty. I usually give Marty a call once a month just to kind of check on him, you know, see what's happening with him.
Right.
So, I do Marty's youth foundation. I've been doing his youth foundation probably for the past 16, 17 years. Well, maybe even more than that, but I'm just throwing a number out there, 16, 17 years. And I've been doing Namath's March of Dimes thing since its inception.
But, that's great.
Haven't talked to Hasty in several years. Last time I saw Hasty was back in 2007 when I brought him to my house for dinner.
Right.
And, hey, you know, we don't get to talk that often. Who else did I talk to? Dennis Blygin. Talk to him every time I come back to New York. And Dennis Blygin.
How about Al Toon? Do you keep in touch with Al Toon at all?
I saw Al Toon when the Super Bowl, I think it was 2012 or 13, when the Super Bowl was in New York.
Yep.
He was he came down for a Jet alumni thing. And no, I'm mistaken. It was the last Jet game in the Meadowlands. We played against the Bengals. Came in town for that.
Okay.
That's the last time I talked to him, last time I saw him. And who else? There's a couple of more guys, man. I can't think off the top of my head. But,
right. Because it took Al Toon a while to get over his concussion issues. I mean, there was a career.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a guy.
Yeah,
he was neck and neck with Jerry Rice. The way you were with certain D-backs, he was neck and neck with Jerry Rice the first 4-plus years of his career till he suffered his first bad concussion. In 1989, I mean, he retired. He was 29. He already had well over 500 receptions. We interviewed Ken O'Brien a little more than a year ago.
Yeah.
And he said that he felt that Al was the best athlete and the smartest guy on the field. And he played, you know, most of the 80s with the Jets. What was your impression being around Al, him as an athlete and a professional?
Well, Al was a... Well, at that time, you know, the need for big receivers was pretty high. You know, right. Al was one of those big receivers, and I didn't see too many guys, you know, really handle Al, you know, too dominating off the line of scrimmage. But, you know, Al did have his share of concussions, you know, coming across the middle,
yeah.
You know, unfortunately. Not... And but yeah, Al and Ken O'Brien, you know, Al and Ken O'Brien. Won a game for us, a much-needed game against the Giants one year when he threw him a fade route in the corner of the end zone on the Jets sideline side of the field. And that was just that was an audible call that was just between those two. It was supposed to be another play that they were going to run that was called. And Al and Ken O'Brien, you know, did their little code signals with the eyes and whatnot and threw a little fade route, and we ended up beating the Giants that year. Giants they had to stay home with us.
That's right.
To the playoffs that year.
I'm glad you mentioned that because that is one of the greatest non-meaningful wins I've ever seen the Jets have. meaning you didn't make the playoffs. It was your rookie year. I'll be straight with you. You guys blew it. The Chiefs were 4-11-1 that year. You lost to them in Kansas City. You tied them at home 17-17. You should have been 10-6 at least, and you should have been in the playoffs. But despite being out of it, the Giants needed that win to make the playoffs, and that is one of my favorite all-time wins. Late in the game, like 30 seconds left, exactly as you described it, that touchdown from O'Brien to Toon. And I was so happy, you know. And the Giants already had won a Super Bowl, but within a year or two, I couldn't stand the fans. Turned me, because I liked the Giants growing up. I didn't hate them. But the fans, once they won a Super Bowl, it was just nauseating, the abuse that I took being a diehard Jet fan.
Yeah.
that game wound up being so meaningful to any Jet fan, at least our age. Me and John are mid-40s now, yeah. So we're right around your age. So, you know, that was an all-time win for us. I'll never forget it. And, Altoon dancing. As soon as he caught the ball, he started dancing. It was a great win, yeah. You know.
Great win. Great win. And you know, to Al's credit, yeah, Al, he's a highly intelligent individual. Super athlete, made great decisions, knew how to sit down in zone coverage, knew how to get open in man-to-man coverage. And, you know, what else can I say about Al, man? Great, smart businessman off the field. So, I mean.
Yeah. He's the only other Jet, other than Joe Namath, I think it was, to win the team MVP 3 straight years. That's how good he was.
Yeah, he did. Yep, he was MVP. That's right. He sure did.
All-Pro in his second year. I'm telling you, he was neck and neck. It sounds like, oh, come on. I mean, Jerry Rice, right? All the records he has, I'm telling you. First 4 full seasons, neck and neck with Jerry Rice.
But if he
and
then
he got hurt in 89. He got nailed against the Steelers.
Right.
And he just, but you know what? Even when he got tagged, he held on to everything. The guy
had hands
of glue. So,
yeah,
all right. So now we're gonna take a quick commercial, and then we want to finish up. We want to get some info on what you're up to these days, and we want to talk about Super Bowl 50 with you.
Is that okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. So we're gonna take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with Eric McMillan and more talk current day Jets. We'll get to him and Super Bowl talk back after these messages.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit. What are you waiting for?
Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gust Buster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Eric McMillan, and we're extremely grateful for him spending as much time as he's chosen to spend with us tonight. Hey, Eric, were you, in terms of your music taste, were you an LL Cool J fan in your college days when he came on the scene?
Absolutely, man. LL Cool J, Queen Latifah, Tribe Called Quest, Eric Sermon, Eric B. and Rakim. I mean, all the Queens, Brooklyn, Bronx, Manhattan, and even Jersey rappers, man. I was down with them all. Man.
I knew I picked the right song for you. And a quick Queen Latifah story for you. My cousin Frank, he owns a lot of car dealerships. Very wealthy guy. Lives out in Colts Neck, New Jersey, where Klecko lives. I think Wayne Corbett lives out there still. And he used to live across the street from Queen Latifah. She moved out to L.A. now because of her show and all that. She has like a talk show and all that. But he used to live across the street from her. And unfortunately for me, I never got to meet her. So I always remind him of that when I get together with him. But, yeah, she's a real good.
Absolutely.
She's an excellent entertainer. All right, so when you left the Jets, just to finish up your career, and you tried to hook on with Buddy Carson with the Eagles and all that, after that 93 season, did you just decide to retire, or you just saw that people were standing in your way in terms of continuing career? What went on with that stuff?
Seemed like I was blacklisted.
Right.
That's what it seemed like. Nobody would shake a stick at me, man.
Right.
They tried to make it seem like, I went to Philly, and I'm used to roaming the field, but that wasn't the kind of defense Bud was running back there. It was mostly cover two.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't make the kind of plays I used to make. You know, Bud and I talked about it before he released me, and, you know, hey, I was cool with it, man. So, I was on my way home, got a phone call from, went to Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Got a call from Saban. Nick Saban was DB coach at Cleveland.
Right.
Saban calls me, you know. And Belichick was the head coach. So I went to Cleveland. Thought I had a good 3 weeks I was there, as a matter of fact. Testa Verde was the quarterback. He was hurt. And they wanted to bring in an extra defensive back, you know. So I got to play next to the likes of a guy named Eric Turner. God rest his soul. He's no longer with us either. But I played with Eric Turner and Frank Minifield and Eric Metcalf was on that team, and we had a pretty good team, man. I was balling there. I had a good time there. But as soon as the quarterback came off of IR, they released me again.
Right.
So I was like, you know what? I've been cut twice in 1 year. This is crazy, man. I don't want to be that guy. So I get a phone call from Schottenheimer, and then Carl Peterson calls me. I told Schottenheimer I've been cut twice in 1 year. I don't want to get cut anymore. I don't want to play this game no more, man. You know, just getting cut stuff is not for me. You know, I'd rather just hang up my cleats. Carl Peterson called me. I told him the same thing. Then they hit me in a weak spot. Hit me with an uppercut with Derek Thomas calling me. Derek was my good friend, and Neil Smith, you know, out of Nebraska.
Yeah.
They both called me up, and, you know, man, look here, we're going to the Super Bowl. You know, we got making a good run at this thing. You know, we got home field advantage. And I'm like, it'd be nice to get a ring, man. So I said, all right, let's do it, man. Let's do it. So, signed with the Chiefs. This is all in 1 year.
Right. No, I know. I know you traveled to three teams in 1 year. I know.
This is all in 1 year. So, you know, I go there, and, you know, we're balling. You know, we're kicking butt. We got Joe Montana, Marcus Allen, Derek Thomas, Neil Smith. The whole secondary is a bunch of all-pro guys.
It's like an all-star team.
DB coach. Oh, yeah, it's like an all-star team.
Yeah,
right.
And we went all the way to the AFC Championship game, man, and Buffalo beat us like they had been in our meetings the whole week, man. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable. And a week before that, we had to come back and beat Houston, down in Houston, because we were losing late in the fourth quarter. And Joe put together a drive that was absolutely phenomenal, and we came back to win the game right at the end. So, another sports story for Joe Montana's credit. But that was a rough period. So after that, man, after that season, I was like, you know what, I can't do this no more, man. I'm hanging up my cleats.
Right.
2 years later, my son is born. My first son is born, and I became a stay at home dad. You know, loving my son and loving being home with him.
Right.
And then I said, you know, I want to play one more year. I want to give it one more shot. And I went to the combine, and guess who I ran into walking across the street?
Don't tell me Bruce Coslett.
Nah, ran into Pete Carroll.
Oh, thank God. Oh, and, Pete Carroll, someone you liked at least. All right, good.
Yeah. So I ran into Pete, and Pete and I talked. We're walking up to the dome, and I told him, what are you doing here? I said, man, I want to come back and play. And he was like, dog, man, I don't have anything for you, but, Ed Donatelle, you know, who was, you know, kind of learning how to coach when he's with the Jets.
Right.
He's now the DB coach in Denver. And Greg Robinson's over there at Denver. Greg came from the Jets as a D-line coach.
Right.
I think, and Greg Robinson was a D coordinator.
Yeah, where was Carroll? Was Carroll in New England?
Carroll was in, I think it was New England. Yeah, I think 96. Is that where he was?
97, right in there when Parcells came to the Jets. Yeah, all right. Yeah.
So he said, you know, he told me he didn't have anything, but he thought Ed and Greg would have something for me. And then I went over there and talked to them. I actually showed up at the bar later that night where I knew they would be. All the coaches go out and have a little drink. So I showed up at the bar and walked up to them and started talking to them. They said, well, you know, it's not going to be for safety. It's for that corner thing. I'm like, corner thing? You're going to make me chase receivers all day again? He's like, well, it's either that or we don't have nothing. I'm like, you know, we got Atwater back. I'm like, yeah, and we got, you know, the other safeties that are over there. I'm like, okay, whatever. Let's do it. So they worked me out, gave me a workout about 3 weeks later. I flew up to Denver, did a workout, and Gary Kubiak's throwing passes. And he's throwing deep balls. I'm catching them, you know, catching them in the lights. They're checking to see, you know, what my mechanics are like and what my decisions are like. Then he throws me this ball. They send me, make me backpedal, open my hips, sends me across the middle like on a square end. Kubiak throws the ball. I was amazed. I had to pat myself on the back for this one. Kubiak throws the ball, man. The ball is like ankle high. And I'm running across the field full speed. I bend down. I snagged it and took it back to the house. I mean, there wasn't no receivers out there. But right. The fact that I caught it, just the fact that I caught it.
Yes.
John Elway's dad was like, shh, why in the hell isn't he playing? Get this kid signed.
Exactly.
Like that.
Exactly.
So if John Elway's dad said, you know, Mr. Elway said, hey, get him signed, the deal was going down. So I just walked off the field that afternoon, and we signed the contract as soon as I came out the shower and signed with the Broncos. And I knew, you can tell, man, you can look around the locker room, you can tell that all the makings for a Super Bowl team was there.
Yeah.
The atmosphere, you can smell it. You can just smell success, man. You just knew it. I just knew they were going to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's when they first got Terrell Davis. They were right on their way.
Davis was the great.
Yeah, that's right.
He was great.
They had Terrell. They had Shannon Sharp. They had Elway.
Yep.
You know, they drafted John Mobley.
They had a great defense.
Yeah, they had a great defense, yeah.
And then they drafted Torrey James. Now, what got me out of Denver? The team went over the cap. When they signed John Mobley and Torrey James on the same day.
Right.
Put the team over the cap. I was last one in, first one out.
Sorry to hear that.
I said, I'm done, man.
Yeah.
I can't do this no more. I got to find something else to do.
That's amazing that the players union couldn't step in and settle a difference for a guy that's in, you know, you're part of a union. It's a profession. I don't, you know, I mean, but there's still a lot that the union doesn't do for former players that suffer from, you know, in terms of medical coverage and all that. So it's still stuff going on with that.
Well, you know, in all due respect to the player association, and you know, as far as the union is concerned, that wasn't a union issue.
Right.
You know, that's just a roster issue.
Right.
And you know, they got to make room for the young guys. I mean, I was, you know, 30-something years old, you know, they got a cat coming in
right.
That's, you know, 20-something years old. He's more than 10 years younger.
I'm actually referring more back to when you had your problems, you know, and then you started getting blacklisted. Forget about when you came back after you had your son and tried to play with you. I'm talking about back like in 93 when you left the Jets, you know?
Well, you know, as far as, you know, what it looks like is, it looks like I can't make a ball club.
Right.
That's what it looks like. So that's not, they really can't, you know, the union can't help you there unless there was something blatant.
Right. You'd have to have proof against something.
Visibly be seen.
I got you.
Yeah, it just looks like I can't make a ball club.
That's far from the truth. So.
Yeah.
I mean, we know the real deal.
You know, and you keep talking about these guys that got drafted, and so you didn't get signed, you had to get let go. And it just made me remember one thing that I had forgotten, and that was that, you know, they drafted – this is my problem with the Jets sometimes in their drafts, because now I'm going to ask about the current Jets, but just going back one last time to the past. You know, you get drafted in 1988, and you're NFL Defensive Rookie of the Year, and James Hasty got drafted the same year, right, and he's an excellent cornerback. So you got your cornerback, you got your free safety. You got a defense. You still got some guys. I know Gastineau got out, but you still had some decent linebackers. You know, they wanted to draft Mo Lewis a little later on. But the 1989 draft, this is like I try not to get livid and upset during drafts because you never know how anybody's going to turn out. But I remember in just following college football, I was a big Steve Atwater fan when he played at Arkansas because the guy could hit. Same thing like with Baxter hitting. I just love the guy. He's coming out of Arkansas. Jets got their safety. Free safety. They got their cornerback. Here comes a strong safety. The draft's going on. Steve Atwater's right there. I mean, he's right there. The Jets need a butt-kicking safety. When it came to the Jets draft and their spot came up, they took Jeff Lagerman. Now, just to be honest with you, I didn't know anything about Jeff Lagerman, and I was just so livid that they passed on Steve Atwater. Steve Atwater winds up getting drafted by the Broncos, having a Hall of Fame career. He's not in the Hall of Fame yet, but believe me, he'll get there someday. And, you know, he was part of what you saw when you got there. He was on that team, Steve Atwater. He's the only guy I've seen not Christian Okoye right on his ass. I mean, he could hit like a truck. And the Jets, if they would have, you know, I'm just talking about early in your career, as good as you were, as good as Hasty was, if they added Atwater at the appropriate time there in the draft, I mean, just what it would have done for the defense, no less that defensive backfield. And Jeff Lagerman, nobody even heard of him. And I actually met him one time when I was out, and I was in a big fan of his personality, but that's another story for another day. But that draft was just bad. And that you reminded me of that just when you were talking about guys getting drafted and then you had to, you know, either leave, you know, first in, first out, whatever it was going to be.
Right.
Now, with the current Jets, I wanted to ask you about, you know, what you saw. Do you still follow the Jets, first of all? Do you still follow their games?
Man, I follow the Jets. I follow the Jets, so yeah.
All right, so you're aware, big season this year. I mean, Brandon Marshall broke every team receiving record. Ivory had a really good year rushing for the team. Fitzpatrick set a record for touchdown passes. What's your impression of this Jets team and this Jets team moving forward?
Well, right now, I'm sitting here looking at the Pro Bowl, you know, and I see five guys. I see the Hawaii Five, as they call them.
Right.
You got Revis, DB, you got Chris Ivory, Nick Mangold, Muhammad Wilkerson, and Brandon Marshall. Okay, you got five guys in Hawaii on the same team.
That's great. I know.
When I played, the most Jets that I was able to go to the Pro Bowl with, you know, was two other guys, was Al Toon and Mickey Shuler.
Right,
you know,
Mickey
the three
Shuler
of
time,
us, you know, shared that 1989. It was 1988. All the three of us went to the Pro Bowl.
Yep.
And then, you know, the 89, I went by myself. But you know, they got five guys there. That defense now, if you listen to me, my conversation is slanted towards defense, okay? I'm a defensive guy, defensive-minded guy. I don't talk a whole lot about offense. I don't know how to run an offense. I know how to disrupt one,
right?
But I tell you, that defense they got, 30 takeaways, man. That's third in the NFL.
Yeah.
Man, five of those takeaways was against the Cleveland Browns, okay? Those guys make plays. That number 45. I don't know names. I know numbers.
Right.
That number 45. That number 20.
Yeah. Marcus Williams had six interceptions this year. Yeah.
Okay. Number 24. We know that is Revis.
Yep. Darrell Revis. I know.
21 and
Marcus Gilchrist is pretty good.
Yeah, 21, 25, and I think that 40. The guy number 41. Last name is it?
Buster Skrine.
Buster
Skrine. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's six guys, man. They got six DBs that made plays for them that came through for them this year.
Yeah, you know, so, Calvin Pryor is a big hit in safety.
You know, the Hawk.
His only issue sometimes is staying healthy, but if he had a pretty good season for himself this year. If he could stay healthy going forward, he could be that big time. I'm not saying he's as big a hitter as Steve Atwater was in his career, but he's on his way to being able to do that. I know he has a little issue with concussions, so we just have to see how that is going forward.
Is that number 21 or 25?
That's 25, Calvin Pryor. 21 is Marcus Gilchrist. He's a cornerback. He had about three picks this year. He did all right for himself. He came out of nowhere, and he contributed in good fashion. Now, as a defense, the defensive backs, for the most part, had all the interceptions. They had 18 interceptions. So they're 10-6. They missed the playoffs because they lost twice to the Bills. So one more win would have got them in the playoffs. So one big play might have got them in the playoffs. And of their 18 interceptions, you want to take a guess at how many they took back to the house as a team?
I don't have that statistic.
All right, well, the answer is zero. The answer is zero.
None.
They didn't have one defensive touchdown this year.
I would love to, and I'm going to throw this out there, man. I would love to be so privileged to work with that secondary and teach them how to hidey ho that thing. Because I look at guys getting interceptions. When I say hidey ho, I'm talking about running touchdowns. Right. But I see guys getting interceptions all the time, you know, whether it's the Jets or whether it's any other team around the league. And I look at them, I'm like, dude, where are you going? You're going in an area where there's a whole lot of people over there. You're not going to get far.
Right.
there's places to go. There's ways to get where you need to get, and I can teach these guys how to do that. I'm going to throw it out there. I would love to work with that secondary if they would let me work with them, man. I'll teach them how to put points on the board.
I wish, and I love Todd Bowles. He's
a great coach.
He's going to do great. I wish he would bring you on his squad.
I do like Todd Bowles.
I really do.
Have you ever, with your
it's
association,
like an injustice almost that you're not on somebody's defensive squad somewhere.
Right, your association with the NFL, do you ever think of having somebody reach out to Todd Bowles and maybe he can invite, even if he invites you into like a mini camp or training camp?
I would love to just, you know, if I can be so privileged to do that.
I think you should contact him. He seems like a real decent. I mean, I only see him in press conferences, and I see how he runs his team, and he seems like a real good guy. I've heard him speak in a few interviews. I got to be honest with you. If I were you, I wouldn't hesitate to reach out to him and ask him if he wanted you to, you know, ball hawking skills is something that you can work on. I wouldn't be afraid to reach out, especially with what you did for the team.
And you had a fantastic career with the Jets.
To be honest with you, well, I appreciate everything you guys are saying. To be honest with you. I've thought about it. You know, I've thought about, you know, somebody reaching out to him, and that person was me. I actually did.
Yeah.
I mentioned it. I met Todd Bowles at the Senior Bowl, and I talked to him and, you know, told him I'm interested. You know, whether or not they follow up, this is, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, well, we will, because I'm hoping that he does something like that. I think that'd be a great addition. You're in the coach, and you bring in the resume with you in terms of what he'd be looking to do, which is create plays on defense, scoring defense. I seen guys, doesn't matter if it was the Buccaneers when they won in 2002 or the Bears in 85, doesn't matter. The Ravens in 2001, big time defenses, they don't just make big defensive plays. They make tackles, they don't give up yards after contact, and when they get those turnovers, they more than seize an opportunity and get the big one in a big spot back to the house for a quick
right.
six.
Right.
So now we talked about the Jets a little bit here. What about what you're doing in your post career? What are you up to these days, and what are you doing with yourself?
Well, right now I'm a high school football coach. I've been coaching high. I actually went back to St. Louis. I was working. I'm all over the place, man. I was working in pharmaceuticals from 02 to 09. I got laid off in 09 due to downsizing. And wasn't able to get back in, wasn't able to, you know, get employed, you know, right away. So I had to find something to do. So I went to St. Louis and got bit by the coaching bug, so to speak, and started coaching basketball. Well, I went there to coach basketball with my uncle down there, because he's a big-time basketball coach in St. Louis on the high school level. And I went to the school's football games, Cardinal Ritter High School. And it's a college prep high school in St. Louis, Missouri. Went down there back in 2010, went to a football game, and I'm sitting in the stands, which is something I rarely do, but I'm sitting in the stands watching what's happening. I'm like, I can't believe they got to do a little better than this. So at halftime, I walked over there to their huddle where they were, and I pulled the coaches to the side. I was bold as hell, man. I pulled the coaches to the side. I said, look, if you do this, you do that. I guarantee they'll throw the ball right to you. So they said, yeah, that sounds good. They took my information over to the team. They didn't discuss it with them, probably because they didn't understand it. And I said, hold on. Before we break this huddle, hold on. Let me explain this to these corners and these safeties. Do this, do that, linebacker. They think you're going to drop out of there. Don't drop. Just stay right there. I guarantee the quarterback will throw it right to you. Next thing you know, interception, boom. Moving forward through that season, they wanted me to come around every day. I kept coming around every day. We won a district championship. All right. Went into basketball season, same thing, district championship.
Right.
Then I come back to Atlanta and end up getting with a high school team here. And we went to the state playoffs. We're in the state playoffs every year, except for last year and the year before.
Right.
But I got one guy up at Duke right now. He's an EMAC disciple.
All right. I like that.
Yeah, he's an EMAC disciple, man. He's made All-American. You know, ever since he's been at Duke playing safeties, number 27, his name is Devon Edwards.
Okay,
he also played point guard in basketball. Yeah, he's, and matter of fact, his teammate, Cash, I can't think of Cash's first name, but he played in the Senior Bowl just yesterday. So, you know, this guy, Devon Edwards, they're talking about him going pro, and I hope he does, man, because I can sit back in my lazy boy chair and say, that's an EMAC disciple right there, man.
There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, that's great. So you're still coaching now. And so you have a lot to do with in terms of developing these guys. And then are you a big part of their recruitment in terms of making sure they make the smart decision for themselves?
I try to be, you know, it's nowadays it's kind of hard to get these kids to listen, man. These kids are, they cut from a different cloth.
Right.
You know, and not everybody shares that same vision. And, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, I played pro ball. Yeah, I was good. But these kids weren't even born when I was playing, man. So, you know, it's hard for them to really, what's the word?
A little different era now, different generation with these kids these days.
Yeah, they, you know. I come around every day. It's no big deal. But if I, you know, if I called over to the Falcons and had, you know, that running back Freeman come over and talk to them, then their eyes would get real big, and you know, they'd be right. Like, wow, you know, because it's somebody they can see.
Yeah, he's on the video game that they're playing every other day or every day. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. So you know, I'm old school, man. So they don't really, you know, some kids have that passion and want to go further and play at the next level.
Yep.
Some have that athletic ability, but. You know, some people don't.
So. Well, if we ever get Todd Bowles on the show, we're going to drop the seed in there. They bring you in on his staff somehow.
Oh, no doubt.
100%.
Hey, man, I appreciate the gesture, man. I appreciate the
thing. I just want to ask, and look, I know you've been here for a long time, and I appreciate it. I know you're watching the Pro Bowl right now. They're doing the draft now, right?
No, they did this. They're playing the game. He's watching the actual game.
Just real quick about the game, the big game, the big Super Bowl 50 on Sunday. What do you think of the Cam's going to win this thing? I think he's electrifying. I think it's really a dynasty what Carolina's doing myself.
I really foresee the Super Bowl as being highly competitive, man, for many reasons. One, you know, yeah, I like Cam Newton. You know, Cam's got that million-dollar smile.
Yeah.
He's a likable kid. He's a young kid. He's a super, super athlete. He manages his offense very well. They have a lot of weapons to work with. But then on the other side, you got got the sheriff, as they call him, Peyton Manning.
Yeah.
You know, this is the final finale for Peyton Manning. You know, Peyton wants to go out, you know, on a high, kind of like Jerome Bettis did, kind of like John Elway did.
Right.
He wants to go out winning that Super Bowl and kind of fade off into the sunset.
Yep.
So, and you know,
and both teams have great defenses.
Both teams have defense. You're talking about the Broncos' number one ranked defense, led by Von Miller, the Marcus Ware. Danny, whatever his name is, Trevathan, or he's number 59.
Right.
And then you got that other guy who's not the Jet player, but his name is Brandon Marshall.
Yep.
And right. Got Brandon Marshall. Defender, exactly. Yep. Yeah. He's great. Yeah. He's good.
And they got good offensive coordinator over there, Wade Phillips, and Wade Phillips knows how to mix up some blitzes and whatnot. But yeah, they got a good defense, and Carolina's got they got a good defense too.
They got Newman.
They got
Kuechly. And the Thomas.
They got Ron
back.
Rivera, man. He's a Buddy Ryan disciple. The way you have an Emac disciple from the 85 Bears. I mean, this guy sat behind Mike Singletary and Wilbur Marshall and Otis Wilson. He studied and learned defense. Like you said, Bud Carson is one of the great defensive minds of all time. Buddy Ryan, the same type of guy. He's one of the great defensive minds.
Same type of guy.
Yeah, this Carolina defense, and I think, Luke Kuechly's All pro. You know what? Thomas Davis went through a lot of knee surgeries. He made first team all pro this year. He just busted his arm in the championship game, put 12 screws in his arm, and he's playing. I tell you what, I think that Carolina's defense, they've had some D-backs knocked out for the season. And the guy's starting, they're still doing a great job. I just think that, you know, like you said with, you know, Peyton Manning, he has a chance to be the oldest quarterback to win a Super Bowl. He has a chance to become the first quarterback to win a Super Bowl with two different teams. But Cam Newton, Eric, he is built like a defensive end. Like they were hoping for you at Missouri. That's the way this guy is built. He's already, like, in terms of just running the ball himself, forget it, his passing is, he's very efficient. But in terms of running the ball, the all-time record for touchdowns by a quarterback running is 43 by Steve Young. He played 15 years. Cam Newton tied that in 5 years. He tied that record.
He's great.
That's how dominant this guy is when he has to run, no less throw. And I just think that's going to be a big difference. And I think that defense for Carolina just showed a lot more consistency. I know Denver played a real great game against Brady, but the week before against Pittsburgh, there was a little hit or miss and a turnover, turning things in their way in the fourth quarter. But I think Carolina's going to take them. I don't know. Who do you think is going to win the game?
That's a real tough call, man. But like I said before, I like Cam Newton, man. I like the things that Carolina and Ron Rivera have done. You know, Ron Rivera, you know, you know, endured some tragedy, you know, going into the season or right around preseason when his house burned up.
And, yes, yeah.
You know, he went through a little adversity with that. And, you know, their defense is really underappreciated, man. I mean, as good as they are, they don't get the respect that they deserve, to be honest with you. But, you know, Denver's got a good defense. And, yeah, they got banged up. The secondary got banged up a little bit in the Patriot game. But it's going to be interesting to see which one of those Broncos defensive backs they're going to put on Greg Olsen, okay? Because it's got to be a defensive back. I don't believe that those linebackers going to be able to cover Greg Olsen on vertical routes.
Right.
I can't see it happening. But no, we'll just have to see.
It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it myself. I can't wait.
I'm hoping for a real physical Kubiak game. I really am.
The guy that was throwing passes to you is now coaching Denver. Yeah. It's kind of funny how things are in the NFL, right?
Yeah. He's got more jewelry than I got too.
That's all right.
He's earned it, no doubt.
Hey, Eric, we want to thank you. We owe you a debt of gratitude for just joining us tonight. It's a true pleasure and an honor. And like I said, I don't know if you. You know, you're watching the Pro Bowl, so you didn't get to watch we have like a feed on our website, sportstalk1240.com. But if you get to look at that when he puts it up on the site, you'll see that I'm wearing that. He'll put pictures up. He'll put up the old, you'll see the old 23, number 22 for Eric McMillan jersey that I'm wearing. And, we just really, want to thank you a ton for joining us tonight and spending basically the 2 hours with us in our show. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. It's been a lot of fun chopping it up with you guys. And I don't do a whole lot of interviews, man. I never really have, you know, not unless I had to, you know, when I, you know, after a game in the locker room.
But right.
I gave you guys a little bit of exclusive information just to kind of, you know, help you guys out on the show. So.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations to you, man.
You're a great Jet.
Talk a little bit.
You're always a great Jet.
You know what? You're an all-time Jet to me. Just like Darryl Ray was the same thing in the early 80s. And for you, four of the most dominant seasons I've seen put up in Jet Green for a defensive back, period. The best I've seen in terms of playmaking. Nobody measures up to you. Eric McMillan, still the all-time leader, defensive touchdowns with 7, interception touchdowns with 5. Nobody's even close to you outside of Mo Lewis, and he's retired also. I don't see anybody ever breaking your record. It's just the way it is.
Well, I appreciate you, man. Thanks for having me, and you know, keep doing what you're doing, man.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us.
All right, take care.
All right, take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
There you go, folks. One of the best defensive backs in Jet history, right? And politics played its way, John, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
horrible.
I didn't like Kozlik before even hear about all this, but that this is the stuff that goes on. It happens to kids in high school, happens in college.
But the talent
for him, it happened at the pro level. He just was.
He had so, you know, it's amazing because he had so much talent.
He was excellent.
He was excellent. And for one coach to come in or GM to come
pro
in.
He was an all pro. You had an all pro safety. That was a ball hawk, and he created touchdowns from defense. There's not a lot of guys in the league that can do that. And he did all that in his first 4 seasons.
Yeah.
I mean, by his 5th season, they were already taking things out of him that they weren't happy with him. You know? Even during his 4th season, he said 90 was fine when Kozlik and Carroll first came in. And in 91, they started to get on his case.
Yeah.
Why? Because he was getting his education taken care of. And
They should be happy.
And he drives through all that traffic to come work out at night.
It's crazy.
What are you doing? Like
they
you said,
be, they should be bending over backwards.
There's only 4 Jet players living in New York at the time.
Right.
Like, who knows with Kozlik?
What is the deal with that guy? I'm so glad that...
You know, it was easier because it was always put out there. You know, how many times did you see on the news when it happened, when he gave Boomer Esiason number 7?
Yeah, it was horrible.
When he signed with the Jets and Ken O'Brien was still on the team.
Yeah, it was horrible.
And you heard so much about that stuff. And the media just didn't cover this issue with McMillan enough. No way. And he was excellent.
They gave him a pass for some reason. I don't think that would jive right now, though. That wouldn't happen now. I think the media is more involved now.
I dislike Kozlik even more now.
Yeah, you know,
like if I wouldn't even shake his hand if I met him at some point. I really wouldn't. And it's probably a reason why I'm not a big Boomer Esiason fan. I really am not. You know, and then when he came in there, those are 2 of the most devastating seasons in terms of blowing a playoff spot.
Yeah.
You know, we went through the end of this season where they lose to Buffalo, they miss out the last game of the year. But, I mean, 1993, where they were 8-5 and lost their last 3 games. And then the next year, they were 6-5 right before the spike ball game with Marino.
Right. I remember that.
They should have won that game. They would have been 7-5 and in first place. Instead, they lost every game the rest of the year. So, like, 93 and 94, what was the size? Some 1-9 in December games? Horrible.
Horrible.
And I disliked them to begin with. I mean, I gave him a chance.
I don't think he wanted to come
but
tonight.
I didn't like the whole issue with Coslett, and I didn't like the way he treated O'Brien. And this thing with McMillan went on and started before that.
And I dislike him even
like
more.
Like I told
now.
Eric, we just didn't hear enough of that.
Yeah.
It's garbage. And I'm glad he took the time. I'm glad we profiled his life as an athlete growing up and up through his Jet years. And I'm glad he told that story. So maybe if a Jet fan listens in, especially guys around our age that were watching,
yeah.
instead of like thinking, oh, he retired at age 26 because he must have had bad knees. No, that's not why. Because the coach had it in for him when he was the best player on defense, and then he made sure that nobody else gave him a fair shake when he left. Think about what kind of personal work it takes to do that.
Yeah.
What kind of a mentality? You know, like you say, treat people the way you want to be treated.
Yeah, that's right.
What kind of a mentality does it take to treat someone like that?
It's horrible what happened to him. It really is. He blackballed him, and his father was in the NFL. He had a great career going. He looked like he was heading off to have a superstar year, superstar career. I mean,
yeah,
with the you know, and
he was a Pro Bowler. He was a Pro Bowler's first year. Listen, if it wasn't his rookie year, he would have been first team All Pro.
Right, that's right.
He was right there with anybody in terms of rookie production. Like Ronnie Lott, his rookie,
you know what else
like Ronnie Lott was a rookie in 81. He had 8 picks. I think he had 2 or 3 touchdown returns for touchdowns. The only reason he didn't win Defensive Player of the Year, and I'm talking about Rookie of the Year in 81, is because Lawrence Taylor came in the same year.
Yeah.
So Lawrence Taylor got it. But, you know, that's how good McMillan was when he got to the Jets.
And he should really be coaching on somebody's defense right now, teaching these kids how to ball hawk and stuff like that.
Well, he's coaching high school. Like it was great.
I mean, he should be coaching the NFL.
I like his idea of coming into Jet, like as a guest coach. You see it all the time with the Mets. Guest instructors, batting coaches, right?
Yeah.
You see it with other sports. The Rangers do it. The Islanders do it in camps.
Right.
They bring back former players.
I'll
tell you what. I hope Bowles listens to what he offered. And even if he's not as familiar with McMillan's resume, maybe he'll do a little research. Maybe ask around a little bit.
All right, real quick. So Super Bowl Sunday's coming up. And what's your pick there, Mr. Wozniak?
You know, I know all the sentimentality and all the hugs and kisses with Peyton Manning, but I think Carolina's going to bury him. I think it's going to be like 24-10.
24-10, huh?
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a big score, too, myself. I think Carolina's going to bury him as well.
Uh-huh.
I think Cam Newton's just going to be too much for them.
Yeah.
And I think Jonathan Stewart's going to be running the ball a little bit, and like Eric McMillan noted, how they're going to cover Olsen.
That's a big. That's
and
a big,
then they got. Yeah, it's gonna be
assignment there. Yeah.
Hey, look. Not only could Cam Newton pass. Look, I'm taking nothing away from Peyton, but Peyton's at the end of this. This is it for Peyton.
All right.
You know.
Give me a score, though.
I'm gonna say 31-21.
There you go, folks. Carolina's gonna blow them out. And as far as being out, we're out.
We're out.
And we'll see you next time.
Go Jets.
1240.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.